once again to what I call American Exposé. It's the 5th of August, 2005. Oh, boy, the mess continues, but you have to realize, listeners, the mess has been going on for I call it the 20th century smokescreen. Many of you realize that. The 20th century smokescreen. We're in the midst of it. Dennis and his directions are very, very obvious to things on our website that indicate what's going on today. But from the past, many things have happened. Many things have happened from the past. The examination of U.S. policy towards POW/MIAs by the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, that's the Republican staff, put this document together Thursday, May 23rd, 1991. Long after, many POWs never returned. Bobby Garwood returned from Vietnam in 1969 to say, yeah, I was with them. They were here. We were here. What happened to you? We have John Coey, who decided not to go into that Vietnam War in 1970. Around that time, he was making decisions, about 1970, more than likely, making a decision, well, am I going to go to Vietnam, or am I going to go somewhere where maybe my purposes will be better fulfilled? Because the Vietnam War was lost. But the Korean War was a mess, too. And it was all under the design of escalation of the war and involving China and Russia and Korea. Same thing with Vietnam is what the History Channel says today. We didn't want to anger Russia and China. So what did they do? Russia and China, communist Soviet Union, communist China, supplied North Vietnam with their weapons. As long as they're supplied with their weapons, they'll continue to fight. This is ancient history, like the war between the states, the Civil War, the war of aggression on state sovereignty. The first thing the North did, well, one of the first things the North did was to blockade the southern ports. So arms, supplies could not come from Europe. That's what we should have done with Vietnam, and we did not. However, John Coey figures, well, this is okay. They just, well, I don't know what his reasoning for thinking of Vietnam, but we knew it was a setup back then. We knew Vietnam was a setup back then because Korea was never finalized, and it was a U.N. operation. POWs never returned from both conflicts. So John Coey decides to go to Rhodesia and fight for their freedom. And he was set up. The people over there were set up, although it didn't receive very much publicity at all. So now what do we have now? Chaos in Zimbabwe. Communist chaos in Zimbabwe. Communists created chaos in Zimbabwe. We've been brainwashed to believe communism's dead. And there is where the problem lies. And, you know, I don't want to take it back much further than that, because we can't come off as conspiracy kooks if we want to increase our numbers. And there's all sorts of opportunities for the other side. And I mean, what is the other side? And who controls the other side? But there's all sorts of opportunities for them to call us conspiracy kooks when we go off on different directions of technology behind the whole system. And I think you know what I'm saying. If not, write notes, and we'll talk about it during the broadcast today with Phyllis Coey, the mother of the martyr that spoke out, John Coey. We'll be back to continue with this broadcast of American Exposé. I'm Chris Turner. Stay with us. Called American Exposé, to the 100,000 American dead of Korea and Vietnam who were betrayed by their own government, listeners, to those who have sought meaning and purpose in life and truth in an age of deceit, deception, and conspiracy. Remember the fundamental truth of Jesus Christ. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father except by me. This is by Corporal John Allen Coey. In the introduction, he refers to Sun Tzu long before many of us knew Sun Tzu, listeners. Supreme excellence in warfare consists in breaking the enemy's will to resist. This is why we took we put Dr. Douglas on yesterday. Red cocaine. This is why I keep putting Hans and Molina on from Czechoslovakia. He experienced it. He has family over there. Experiencing it still. Communism's not dead, listeners. It changes its face on a daily basis in many respects. So what has become known as the Vietnam era was a period marked by rabid protests. Each day, on the tube, hysterical and unwashed anti-war demonstrators paraded before the American people as the quote-unquote news commentators pontificated about the protesters' moral commitment to stop the killing in Vietnam. Of course, now that Indochina has been captured and the communal butchery of entire populations has begun, not even the faintest sigh of dismay can be heard from either the noble mobs or the gentlemen of the media. Unfortunately, neither the deluded apostles of peace who roamed the streets at that time, nor the perplexed silent majority who watched their antics had the slightest notion of what was really happening before their eyes. If either group ever wondered why a government engaged in active warfare against communist forces in Vietnam was at the same time busy pumping massive economic transfusions to shaky communist regimes all over the planet, and indirectly North Vietnam itself, they quickly put the thought out of mind. And he refers to the book National Suicide by Anthony Sutton. For none of them realized that the war in Vietnam was actually a war on America. The broad mass of Americans never became informed enough to know that they were victims of psychological warfare. They were never aware that they had been forced into playing an old-fashioned political game called the choice between false alternatives. The country had been artificially divided between the hawks and the doves, between those who supported the government's war and those who opposed it, between military-industrial conservatives and campus ivory tower liberals. These were the sides, and each citizen was supposed to choose between a protracted no-win slaughter and a humiliating surrender. Either choice led to the same result, demoralization of the American people. Therein lay the purpose of the war. No one was supposed to know that America had been programmed to lose and her people conditioned into psychological demoralization, the gradual wasting away of will to resist. That is why it was decided that one of the smallest and most underdeveloped of all the communist satraps would defeat the United States. The confused and befuddled American people would never know the control of their national government had already slipped from their hands in a secret and bloodless seizure of power in 1913. And listeners, that's where I take it back. I don't take it back any further than that, because listeners, we have to increase our numbers. We have to get the entire population on the same page. Don't confuse the situation any further back than 1913. This is what I say. We have to stop coming off and giving ammunition for the other side to call us conspiracy kooks. And you have to think about that, listeners. Take it back to the Federal Reserve System. Obviously, this is where he's talking. This young man, John Coey, way back when, early 1970s, has it right. They would never learn that government policies are made by the mysterious agents of even more mysterious family dynasties, such as the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds. Doesn't change today, listeners. Those are set in stone. Who long ago carved up the world into economic spheres of influence. They would never fathom the horrible truth that wars such as Vietnam are planned for profit, power, and demoralization. And there's where we draw the line right now. We have the same thing going on in the Middle East right now. The exact same thing. And when you understand the big picture in place, people, and we try to make it as simple as possible on AmericanExpose.com, you have to realize that in Iraq is the Worker Communist Party of Iraq and the Iraqi Communist Party. We have total control of that country now under the guise of the UN system by the coalition, and yet the Worker Communist Party in Iraq, the Iraqi Communist Party is in place right now. It's on our website, AmericanExpose.com, American spell with a K. Phyllis Coey is our guest today. She'll be with us for 2 hours. We're going to take your calls throughout this broadcast. But A Martyr Speaks by John Coey is a prolific book. Phyllis, welcome to the broadcast.
And my pleasure to have this opportunity again.
Well, not enough time is devoted to your direction by all of us. And we see the pattern, don't we, Phyllis?
Yes, indeed. Just quickly, Chris, I would like to say that what you just quoted,
yes,
is actually the introduction to my son John's journal. It was written by his brother Ed.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that.
Sure.
This is a rather dog-eared copy of the book that I've had with me since you sent it to me in California.
Oh, well, I sent a current printing to you.
Did you send it to the P.O. box?
I think I did, yes.
Okay. I haven't been there yet.
Oh, okay.
But I was very fortunate to find the book. And, John Coey, let's see, it was his name, Pat? Let's see, no, wait a minute, I'm sorry. That would be G. Edward Coey.
Yes, that's my older son. That was John's brother.
And he's still with you now?
Yes.
Okay. And this is done July 1977, this introduction.
That's right. That's correct.
Okay, and I haven't even covered the foreword of the book. But, listeners, this is a journal of deception, isn't it, Phyllis?
Yes, it is. If I could just go through the story from the beginning, because some maybe new listeners or so on might think, why are we going back 30 years with this? Well, what I'm hoping they'll do is, as you just pointed out, Chris, is to connect the dots with that period of time, the Vietnam War, and right on through the so-called first Gulf War and what's going on now. And I'm hoping we will help save the lives of some of their children, sons, daughters, grandchildren, great-grandchildren now, and quit sending them to the slaughter.
Absolutely. And you have the floor, Phyllis. You hear the commercials coming up, and let's hear from the mother of John Allen Coey. It's harrowing. It's frightening to me, anyway, and very, very discouraging. Continue, Phyllis.
Well, we as a family were very united. That's my husband and myself and our two sons. And our two sons, John and Ed, were in high school and college during the Vietnam period. Well, they were among the few who were very, very well informed and understood the enemy and understood what was going on around them. So by 1972, John was graduating from Ohio State University and was to be drafted to be sent to Vietnam. Well, as you just quoted from my son Ed's introduction here, John was caught in between these factions. But he was willing to do honorable service somewhere, somehow, as a young man. So he looked around, and we kept hearing about this little country of Rhodesia that was a threat to world peace. It had UN worldwide sanctions put against them, and we'd been following this for a long time. And so John thought, well, That looked like some place where he could go as an individual, not connected with any organization, and serve honorably. And so he had everything in line. He left the day, he left Rhodesia the day after he graduated from Ohio State University, March of 1972. Now, he did not run. He did not hide. He, in his journal, you will find his soldier's protest that he had written. And when he left, he mailed that to his senators, his congressmen, his pastors, his family, everybody, and told exactly where he was going and why. And so he did serve in Rhodesia for 3.5 years. Eventually, he did serve there as a medic.
Keep in mind, listeners, Phyllis Coy is the mother of John Allen Coy, a martyr speak. Stay with us. We'll be back to return with Phyllis. We're back with the broadcast. So many directions going on that I'm receiving, having been on this re-establishment of me on Republic, put it that way. So many listeners, so much information. And yet we have to deal with the deception of today by learning from the deception of the past. Long before Michael New made his courageous stand, John Coy made his courageous stand. And most people don't have a clue about it. And we're going to make those books available next week when Sandra gets back. That's where we're going. We're going with this. Phyllis, continue with your direction, please.
Well, thank you. And I'm glad you mentioned Michael New, too, because I certainly want folks to support him. John, actually, as far as we can determine, was the first American to refuse service under the United Nations. Of course,
well,
that was one of the main reasons he wouldn't serve.
Most people didn't even know it was a Vietnam operation in Vietnam, did they?
No. No, they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to quote here from John's soldier's protest that I mentioned that he sent out. I'll give two quick quotes here from that.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote, "The military may be rendered unfit for war." Now, I'd like to remind your listeners, John was 21 years old at the time. Okay, so he's writing here. "The military may be rendered unfit for war. It may still be used to enforce totalitarian government if made a part of the UN, end quote, peacekeeping forces. No soldier is obliged to serve revolutionaries, opportunists, and subversives attempting to break all constitutional restraints on the power of government." And then a little further on, this is quite a lengthy dissertation that he wrote, "Every officer and enlisted man has sworn allegiance to both the Constitution and the President. That oath of allegiance is exclusive now, and each must choose either to fight for the liberty of this republic or serve the corrupt oligarchy that intends to destroy it. I wish only to help Americans regain control of the destiny of our country." And that's an excerpt from his soldiers' protest that he mailed out to everybody. And then, as I said, he had quite a few hard knocks then when he got to Rhodesia. Now, I would like to say this. Let's go back to 1965, because Rhodesia declared their independence from Britain at that time and had set up their constitution. And I thought we'd done that with our country, too, didn't we?
Yes.
And it was a free, independent country. Of course, they had worldwide sanctions against them after that, and they were not a part of the United Nations. And I will say this, that John then was not the only American that went there as an individual to serve. In fact, there were men from all over the world that went just to try to help out with the situation out of their own convictions. Now, they did serve in the Rhodesian military. They wore the uniform. They were not asked, any of them, to give up their citizenship. And the reason they served in the full military, as everybody else did, the rest of the military, was because of the press that depicted these people as being mercenaries, you see. and racist, and, you know, all the slander that was put against them. Well, they served as everybody else did, and I'd like to point out later on when John become a medic, if you're going out into the bush chasing down these communist-trained terrorists to get them out of the country of Rhodesia, and you're wearing canvas shoes and short pants, and you have a little medic's bag, and you're getting $100 a month, I don't think you're a mercenary. You know, I think that would come under conviction.
Uh-huh.
And that was the situation. Because, as I said, they were a landlocked country. And having these sanctions put against them, they couldn't get oil. And see, they had these, as I back up, they were a free, independent, beautiful country. Totally civilized. The people could live however they chose. If, say, the black Rhodesians, if they wanted to live as they chose on their tribal trust lands and live in that manner, they could. I mean, the people were free to live as they wanted. Now,
right.
what would happen, Chris? The press, we would hear so many times, they'd say, oh, the Rhodesian security forces, they've gone into a mission school, and they have killed innocent women and children. And we would hear propaganda like that. Well, what happened? See, Mozambique and the neighboring countries are already under Marxist control. And these trained Marxists would come over the border into Rhodesia, and they would kidnap perfectly innocent black people, and many of them children. And then they took them back into Mozambique. They may be sent to Cuba, to some of the Eastern Bloc countries at that time. And they would be trained, you know, as Marxists. And then they would be part of the contingencies coming back in over the borders to destabilize Rhodesia. Well, of course, you never heard any of this. Well, then many of these so-called mission schools in Rhodesia were not true mission schools at all. The Marxists would set them up as that. And a lot of them got support from the World National Council of Churches, from the Jesuits, from the Mary Knowles. Let's face it, they're all part of it. And then when the security forces would be chasing down these Marxist terrorists, and many of them would be harbored in these, quote, so-called mission schools.
All right, Phyllis, continue your thoughts as we go into the commercial pause. Listeners, we're listening to Phyllis Coy, listeners. Very important information. We'll be back to continue. With the broadcast called American Exposé. Listeners, Phyllis Coy is our guest. This is very, very important information, people. This is history repeating itself today in the Middle East mess. It's nothing more than that. History repeating itself. John Coy certainly knew what was happening in Vietnam, as did his brother. The family were a solid group. The family, the Coy family. The family unit is under attack, has been under attack for many, many decades. We listen to Phyllis some more. Continue, please, Phyllis.
Thank you, Chris. I would like to say that when John went into their SAS, that's the Special Air Service,
yes,
training,
mm-hmm,
and he was doing very well. In fact, he was second in his class when they were due to complete their courses. And he had written an article for a paper out of South Africa called the South African Observer, which was a very astute publication at that time. And John wrote an article entitled The Myth of American Anti-Communism. Well, he suddenly was no longer on the course. So, of course, that proved then that Rhodesia was getting very well infiltrated,
mm-hmm,
or that wouldn't have happened. But John went on. He wouldn't let anything stop him at that point. And then that's when he decided to go into the medical corps, become a medic. Now, as a medic, he set a precedent with that because they had a policy at that time that the wounded could be taken to camp. And John said, oh, no, I can't have any part of that. He said, I have to be out there. They would go out with a what they called a fire force stick, a fire running down these terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went out with his men, and he said, I have to be there. Because he said, not only to be on the spot to tend to them medically, I have to be there to witness for Jesus Christ and save their soul. And this was John's life. And
yes.
So it was 3.5 years, and they were caught in an ambush July 19th, 1975. And as you can see, your timing on this interview is very important to me because I'm reliving every bit of this right now. At these particular times, we always do. We had just had his funeral this time 30 years ago. And as I said, this did set a precedent, and from then on, the medics were sent out, with the troopers, as they called them. And this was our John's life. They were caught in an ambush, and he gave his life trying to save these wounded men.
Mm-hmm.
Now, getting back to Rhodesia as such, the country that it was, they had all these wonderful natural resources. They had the best chromium in the world. They were exporting food. Now, I hope people will please absorb this and compare it with what you hear now,
mm-hmm.
with Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear about squatters in Harare. Well, Harare was the beautiful capital city of Salisbury. And, of course, they changed all the names of the towns and so on when Mugabe and the Marxists took over. Now, why do we have squatters in Harare? Well, most of these people were the black folk who were employed. I mean, they were employed on the farms as workers. I mean, they had an income, they had a job. They worked on the farms. They weren't enslaved, or all the propaganda that we hear. Well, of course, the farms were confiscated and taken over, and the Mugabe has some of his kin folk, shall we say, just moved in and lived on. I mean, it's a total disaster. Nobody's being fed.
It's created crisis, isn't it, Phyllis?
Yes. Yes.
Nothing more.
That's it.
Created crisis. History repeating itself.
Absolutely. So now we have these big meetings where, we have to send this food to these poor people.
Yeah.
And they had been exporting food.
And they...
But you can't get... so many people today never even heard of Rhodesia, which is... In fact, I talked to someone just a while back, and they had been over to Zimbabwe as missionaries, and they're back in the States, and a friend of mine talked to them who knows the situation as I do, and they said they had never heard of Rhodesia. They just thought it'd always been with Zimbabwe, and they should be there to help.
Well, that makes sense to me because of the writers of history. They keep it suppressed, don't they, Phyllis?
That's right. That's right. And so when we got word of John's death, my husband was unemployed at the time. My elder son, Ed, had been a teacher in the Columbus, Ohio public schools trying to teach history and teach as he should, and he had lost his job. He wasn't politically correct then, and this goes back to the 1972.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to make the decision, John's death. Do we bury them here, there? What do we do? Well, they had an organization in Rhodesia at that time, just the plain, good, ordinary folk there who had an organization they called the Terrorist Victims Relief Fund, and they were trying to help other people as they could who had been victims. And bless their hearts, they paid our way over. We decided to go ahead and have John buried there because we felt he deserved the full military honors. We felt he deserved what was due him, not for personal glory. So they paid their way over there. Well, another purpose for going there, Chris, was the fact that I knew John had kept this journal every single day, the whole 3.5 years from the day he left to the time of his death. And he had hoped on his return, of course, to have it published for two reasons, the political truth and his Christian witness. And I had made him a promise that for any reason he couldn't get that done, I would never quit until it was done. And so when we were there, we began our search for his journal. Well, we couldn't find it. All we had, all he had left in the world was his footlocker with some few personal belongings in it, and we couldn't find his journal, and we had to come back to Ohio without it.
Well, but that was somewhat devastating.
It was devastating, but I have to, the way the Lord works in these things, you know, he never lets you down.
Right.
So it took a year, and, well, we did find out sort of through a grapevine that it had gotten into the wrong hands. So a year later, we did get the remnants of his journal. And, of course, a good bit of the political truth had been censored.
Mm.
But how it was saved was the fact that when John would write home, he would write directly from his journal, because for two reasons, it saved him time, and then it gave us information that we needed. And we did get his letters. And not all of them at the very last, we didn't. But most of them we did. So then my son Ed and I took us almost a whole summer, and we pieced together what was left of the journal with the letters that John had written home, and that's how we got his whole story, the whole journal together. And then it took me 13 years to get a publisher.
And there was a big challenge in addition to the other challenges.
Yes.
And keep in mind, listeners, 11 years earlier, something called Katanga took place, right, Phyllis?
That's right.
That was not publicized in this country at all whatsoever, except maybe through the John Birch Society, maybe.
Well, we really can go back to the very top of Africa, going back country by country by country. You can start with Algeria, really. You know, way back at the top, and just coming down through the continent. They had the Congo, you know, we had Katanga, we had the fall of Mozambique, you know, on and on and on. Of course, we're all the way down to the Cape now with South Africa.
Gone. Good point.
So, as I said then, 13 years, and I did find a very valiant lady who heard about John and was inspired. She had published several books herself, the New Puritan Library, which actually was she and her husband in their own home. And we didn't have the money to do it, and those folks took it on and done the first publishing for us. And so how this has gone on now for all these years is just box by box and book by book. And the publisher would let us order books as we could, just pay for the books as we could, and pay for the shipping, and we have hoofed it. We've gone, you know, many miles, just driving, walking, and then when shortwave radio come along, bless the hearts of all of you who have given me these great opportunities to have the interviews on shortwave, and you've been a big part of this to help.
Thank you.
Well. And then the first publishing was done in 1988, and then we did manage to get those books out and around. Actually, it went worldwide. And I want to stress, too, now this was not done for personal glory. It was not done for money. It was done, the journal has been done first and foremost to the glory of God and for truth. And that's what John would want. Now, I'd like to explain the title, A Martyr Speaks, because the first publisher, the New Puritan Library folk, they wanted to know if they could select the title, because John had not selected one. So we said, sure. So they're the ones who selected A Martyr Speaks, because they were very affluent in the Greek and so on. They said, well, after all, you know, the martyr in Greek means witness. And John was a witness for spiritual and political truth. So that's why we have the title, A Martyr Speaks. And we were very pleased with that.
Yes.
There are some, that's why I like to explain it, though, because some folks that, you know, at first glance or first thought or so, oh, well, you know, he was John was setting himself up as that. Well, not at all. Not at all.
Right.
I would like to quote here, John wrote in 14th of October 1972 in one of his letters home. He said, I think the Christian soldier should be, as was said of Robert E. Lee, a foe without hate, a friend without treachery, a soldier without cruelty, a public officer without vice, a private citizen without wrong, a Christian without hypocrisy. He ought to strive to be Caesar without his ambition, Frederick without his tyranny, and Napoleon without his selfishness.
Mm.
So that was in one of his letters home. And this was so typical of John. Also back later on, let's see, when was this? He wrote this, it was in 72, after he'd been there a while. He said, I have been taught that one should be a soldier, warrior, and crusader for God, country, or anything worth fighting for. And he said, it seems that under present conditions, one cannot be a soldier without furthering the aims of the internationalists, the liberals, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Zionists, and other alien groups. Now, I believe it's a Christian's duty to oppose the enemies of his civilization just as much as it is to save souls. I have heard it said that freedom is God-given and given only to those willing to fight for it, even if it means opposing the state. That's another quote he wrote home one time.
Yes. Very appropriate. As we see here, listeners, dated July 31st, thousands forced to leave, or actually forced to go on leave as fuel crisis bites. As many as 300,000 drivers and conductors in the public transport sector around the country have been set on forced leave as effects of the crippling fuel situation worsen, listeners. The Standard has established Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions Chairman Lovemore Mutombo said an estimated 100,000 long-distance drivers and 200,000 from the informal transport sectors had stopped going to work due to the fuel shortages. And see, the created situation, the created crisis all over the world, country by country, that's it, country by country. Here it is in Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe today. You see how the pattern works, don't you, Phyllis?
Well, Chris, I appreciate the extra. I've never had this much time to tell the story before, and I appreciate it so much. And this, I'm going to tell something that we've not told before.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, as I said, Rhodesia being landlocked and not having access to oil and so on and crippling their transportation, and they were... So there was a fellow here in the States at that time who had invented was called a sauna unit. And this could be put on any kind of vehicle, and you never had to change the oil.
Hmm.
And so my husband, you see, as we got on into the time that John was serving over there, see, my husband couldn't get employment.
He was blacklisted.
Mm-hmm. And then I told you the situation is my son teaching school.
Right.
Okay, so my husband was unemployed anyhow, and we were in touch with these particular people, and they said, and some people may not be familiar with the term, it was called sanction busting. Sanction busting were people who were taking a stand for Rhodesia and managing to get some of the, and going through the blockades and so on, getting some things through to them that they needed. And so these folks asked my husband, would you take the sauna unit to Rhodesia if they paid his way and present it to the people? This could have saved the life of Rhodesia. And again, we never tell these things for personal glory. None of it was done for that, and I want to stress that.
Right.
So absolutely. Anyhow, yes, we were unemployed anyhow.
Right.
Had buried our son, and so my husband went over. And the people were so receptive. I mean, this was free enterprise at work.
There you go.
You see. and they didn't ask for aid. They didn't help for. They said, if you show us how to do this, we can make it. You see.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were pretty well on our way, and I can't go into all the details, but to get to the point of the story, we were sold out. I mean, after all, the that couldn't be tolerated.
Free enterprise can't be tolerated.
No. Well, and to get these people the need, you see, this could be, this sauna unit could be used on anything, you see, locomotives, trucks, personal automobiles, anything. We had one on our car here.
Interesting.
And we just never told this before.
Well, this is all very, very important information, listeners, and it's so relevant today with the Middle East mess, listeners.
Oil. Oil and the money and the banksters. See, it's the same. That's why it's connect the dots, people.
There you go. We'll be back to continue with Phyllis Coey, listeners. If you want to get involved, 800-313-9443 is the number to call. And welcome back to the broadcast. That is Poker Face, listeners. A rock group that is always vilified and left in the dark. Never given the opportunity to play their music like others do. Pokerface.com is the website. Support them as you can. Listeners, here I see women turned to cross-border prostitution from the Zimbabwe Standard, July 31st, 2005. A massive clampdown on cross-border trading has seen more Zimbabwean women with no source of income resorting to cross-border prostitution. In the past, unemployed women sold foodstuffs such as dried vegetables, ground nuts, and sweet potatoes, among many other things in neighboring countries, that their trade is becoming increasingly unprofitable owing to the so-called Operation Marambatswana and other measures adopted by the government to rein in perceived forex leakages. It's on the website, AmericanExpose.com. It's here. The article's here for you to see. AllAfrica.com is the source of this information. See how the pattern goes. This is the point. This is why this book is so vital today. Because here we are in the... Well, face it, the world is encapsulated into communism, Phyllis.
Well, it's not dead.
No, communism's not dead at all whatsoever. And there's the point. We'll start taking phone calls in the next hour. 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443. Keep in mind, we wouldn't have this forum if it wasn't for John Stadmiller and his wife. And there's the point. Support it. Pledge your support to Republic Broadcasting at 800-724-2719. The book will be available at the network. I'll talk to Sandra when she returns next week and see how we can engineer this promotion of this wonderful book, listeners. And they talk about the fact that it's in the memory of those killed defending Christian freedom. And see how God has been taken out of the schools. See how God has been taken out of every facet of life today. For a reason and a purpose, listeners. And our battle is on our doorsteps now. We don't understand that this country here, farmers for decades have been paid not to plant. We are in situations in the future where the UN sanctions can be put on this country to starve us into capitulation. We have Costco ports, China Ocean Shipping Company ports, all over this country, East and West Coast, Gulf of Mexico. China has control of the Panama Canal. Why in the world would China want to control the Panama Canal, listeners? The plan is in place. The worldwide dominating plan is in place. And it's up to us to wake up America here at Republic Broadcasting and get educated quick. A Martyr Speaks, the journal of the late John Allen Coey, is available at Republic Broadcasting. We'll continue into the second hour, 800-313-9443. Phyllis Coey is our guest. Stay with us.